Welcome to Business IQ Radio. You're here listening to Don Byrne. Hey, Don.
Hey, hello. How are you today, Andrea? Glad to have you with us today, as always.
Thank you. And Andrea O'Brien from the Small Business Development Center there in Manchester.
Here in 105.1 WBNH. And Andrea, we have a very interesting guest for today. This is a fellow who I've come across who's involved in technology, disruptive and innovative technology, especially as it relates to sort of well-established businesses like security. Have you ever given any thought? Do you see that there's a need for innovation in the area of security in any way, shape, or form?
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that because earlier this week I was listening to NPR, another radio station, and they talked about a task force happening that's wrapping up their findings in the state of New Hampshire, a task force dealing with school safety. One of the groups that make up this task force is dedicated to technology. And I think they're looking for cutting edge technology that will make the school safer. And maybe, you know, you could call it disruptive technology. And I'm wondering if that has, you know, if the new developments in technology are going to make a positive impact.
Well, we should certainly ask our guest, John Gallagher, with Viacu about that topic. And I see it in some other areas. I'm concerned about some of the ways in which technology can upset our economy a little bit and obsolete some jobs. So there's something
along
that line to talk about.
AI.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Artificial intelligence. Right.
And you know, self-driving cars and things like that. I will tell you, however, I know that, and maybe we can actually tease John in the beginning of our conversation, because he actually has some expertise in a topic I know that you're very interested in, which is bitcoins.
Oh, yeah.
He's a really smart guy. He designed his own Bitcoin mining computer.
He
designed the chips. He has a background in doing chip design, so he actually had chips go out to a foundry and create them, and he had it specially designed.
Brilliant guy.
With all of our guests that have all of this great expertise, the challenge will be, can they, you know, make this understandable for mere mortals, you know, to people like you and me.
Right.
So I think that'll be the big focus. So we'll talk about that, and we'll let the conversation go wide and far. I think one of the areas that, you know, if we do start talking about bitcoins, and I don't know if we'll get into that or not, but if we do, I really want to talk about the underlying technology, the blockchain, because, you know, it's one of the ways I'm aware of all these companies that are starting out, and they're using that technology to really give you confidence in the information. And one of the most interesting ones that I've seen is an initiative on the part of several companies looking to offset the quote-unquote fake news by validating that the original source of the news really is the person who it's attributed to. Mm. So that if something, you know, if you say, well, this was said by Don, was it really said by Don, or was it said by somebody else, and they're creating that as a false illusion? So it'll be interesting to get
we would all benefit by getting rid of fake news.
Yeah, and at least you know where things are, where they're coming from. So and they're involved. I know his company is also involved in museums, and so, you know, shipments of products and goods, and validating that they are what you're getting. Is so many frauds out in the art industry and even in some other areas. So we'll see how all that winds up. So I think John's going to be joining us by phone. So why don't we, I think I see the line is
from Silicon Valley.
He's out in California.
I wonder what they talk about at dinner parties.
Well, we should ask him.
Okay.
That'd be a good opening question. So on that note, why don't we just bring John in here to WBNH 105.1 Business IQ Radio. Well, welcome, John Gallagher from Viacu Corporation to Business IQ Radio. Glad to have you with us.
Great to be here, Don.
Excellent. So we mentioned to our listeners in the beginning that the topic, and maybe I didn't get it quite right, I tried to explain that you really have a lot of expertise in having been in a number of business opportunities and in the field where disruption is taking place. And disruption is one of those words that sort of have two meanings, both positive and negative. Maybe you can just start, let's start the conversation by asking you a little bit, or can you give us and the listeners a little bit of background on where you came from and, you know, what you're doing these days?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, the short version is, you know, essentially I came out of engineering school back in the late 80s. And, you know, really, as many young engineers do, you know, you start to really look at the landscape and say, okay, where do I want to plant my flag? And it was pretty clear at the time. I was very drawn to high technology. I mean, what I studied in engineering school was semiconductor physics. Likely place I'd end up was, well, gee, here in Silicon Valley. And, you know, with some graduate work and MBA along the way, this really was absolutely the right place for me. And in the spirit of, you know, the last 30 years, I've seen a lot of interesting companies come and go. I've seen a lot of interesting companies come and stay. And, you know, thankfully, I've been involved in some interesting, I'll call it disruptive technologies. I mean, disruption and innovation are maybe two sides of the same coin. So I like to focus on the innovation, but typically if it's really innovative, then that does lead to disruption in the existing industry.
Yeah, and let me pick up on that a little bit, which is, I know Andrea will like this. One of the first times I was introduced to John, he was actually explaining, we had a conversation about Bitcoins because he's somebody who could actually design his own chips to do some Bitcoin mining. I don't know if he ever did that, but we've done a show on Bitcoin. So Andrea had just sat forward in her seat. She's interested in this topic.
Oh,
do you own
Andrea,
any?
Let's have a side discussion.
Do you own any Bitcoins? Do you dabble?
Straight to the throat on that one.
Sorry.
Yes. Short answer is yes. But do I own as much as I mined? No. Because along the way, I honestly viewed it as a thought exercise. You know, can one take up an interesting new technology, start to dig into it? And again, from an engineering perspective, and as Don had highlighted, right, I came out of a chip design kind of, you know, background. And so to me, the real fun was the actual doing. The goal, the ego goal that I had was I had to make my own Bitcoin. Sure, anybody could go buy it. I wanted to make my own
Bitcoin machine, Bitcoin miner, right?
Well, Bitcoin miner, and yeah. I used the miner to the point of getting a Bitcoin, right? Once I got to a Bitcoin, right, and that took a couple months. But once I had actually mined a Bitcoin, I honestly started losing interest.
Okay,
you know, and then it became all the overhead, right? Because if you run a rig, so to speak, right, a bunch of miners together, the noise generated by the fans is significant.
I was just going to say that it's a mystery. You know, it's an enigma. It's this, the emperor has no clothes, this whole Bitcoin thing. When you find a Bitcoin, like, and you actually go to your screen in the morning, is there like a little jackpot icon that comes up, or
dollar sign
winner? You know, like
no. Let me actually undo a misconception, which is that sure, there is the case where one actually finds a Bitcoin, and I'll gloss over it, and obviously you've done a show on it, so I'm not going to go into the detail. They would have. But, you know, if you really think of it, Bitcoin is created or earned in two ways. It's created, well, actually, it's not created, right? It's just there. Mm-hmm. And there's a fixed amount, a finite amount, call it in the crust of the digital earth. And so, sure, there are mining operations that will extract that new Bitcoin. And that's becoming rarer and rarer because, again, there's a fixed number. X many have already been mined. There's only X many left. And so there is a theoretical limit and even a specific time frame in which there will be no more extractable Bitcoin. But the other side of the equation, this is what I was playing, was that you get incremental Bitcoins. You basically get a toll, right? So when a transaction happens, part of the security features of a Bitcoin transaction is that it's a blockchain register that gets passed widely and has to be authenticated multiple times, multiple people, to authenticate that the transactions are still valid. And the encryption that is used for that authentication is super heavy duty, and therefore the compute resources needed to do it are super heavy duty. And your Bitcoin earnings come mainly these days from doing those transactions, from actually verifying a transaction has taken place.
Wow.
So it's not you wake up in the morning and the screen has all turned green with dollar sign and showered all over it. It's more that you wake up in the morning and you're like, oh, I got 0.05. Oh, my God. Last night was great. and you slowly...
And there's not a rainbow landing at your house with a with a pot there with a coin sitting in a little crock or something like this, like you'd see.
Crazy. still kind of escapes me. I hate to say it.
Yeah. But. So, well, it's a very interesting technology. And who knows, maybe if we can, maybe let's reserve a little bit of time in the show to talk a little bit about the application of blockchain technology.
Absolutely.
In some of the areas that I know you're involved in, which you're very heavy into the security industry these days, right, John?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's actually the company I'm with, Viaku. We're a disruptive, innovative Silicon Valley startup, and our specific focus is physical security. And the application of blockchain is definitely, I'll call it, in the air in our industry. And more pervasively, it's really, I'm just going to say broadly, I even as dirty as my hands got with it, I don't really think of it still as a currency as much as a technology.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of the technology is validation and verification, right? So that you really know that something is what it is. And in physical security, that's meaningful because, obviously credentialing, identity management, chain of custody for video evidence. There's a lot of other applications where blockchain actually is meaningful. I mean, we've built into our product technology, for example, if somebody goes in and changes a file while it's supposed to be in its retention period, many people say, oh, yeah, you have to keep video for 30 days or 90 days. Well, it's surprising, but it does happen that people go in and try to tamper with those files. We'll detect that, and we have some sophisticated technology to do it. But ultimately, something like blockchain applied to that data file could also do that and do it in a more, I'd say, broader and, more distributed sort of way. You wouldn't necessarily, you always need us. But no, you might not necessarily need Viaku as a product to do that for you. It may just be embedded in what we do and what everybody else does. So I hugely believe in blockchain in that sense. I think it is taking hold and will continue to grow. But currency-wise, not so sure.
You know, it's always interesting when we have a guest on that is an expert, a subject matter expert in technology, because
they're some of our most popular shows. They really are.
That's good. But
I
think
of interest,
the challenge is for somebody like yourself, John, is that when you talk to people who are not at your level, that comfortable with technology, do you find that it's an easy topic to discuss? I mean, when you're at the dinner party table, I mean, you are in Silicon Valley.
Or the cash bar, as you say, Andrea.
When you're at the cash bar. I mean, the challenge is to make the conversation one, not, I'm not pointing this at you, but I'm just saying in general, when we talk about technology of any kind, making it something that a regular person, if you don't mind me using that expression, can identify, this is how it's changed my life, or this is how it works every day in my life. What disruptive technologies can we look to that? So encryption, is that you're telling us that that's kind of a disruptive technology, that there are things happening in encryption today? Is that Did I repeat that?
Yeah, I mean, I would go a little more specific than encryption, right? Because we've been using encryption for a while, so I wouldn't call that necessarily disruptive. But it's the creation of a blockchain type methodology which uses encryption in an elegant way, and then can be applied to. My favorite example is, again, I'm getting too techie focused. Andrea, you've put me on notice here.
Okay.
So let me
come back and answer your
question.
Well,
it's
Don's fault.
This is for mere mortals, so sure.
Well, so I mean, Don loves, his eyes just sort of glaze over when he starts talking to people who are, because Don loves, and the rest of us just want to know more. Like we want to be able to embrace it and understand how technology betters our life.
Well, Well, let me give an example, and this is one I'm even on shaky ground. But you know, if I want to stay with blockchain here for a moment, it's the idea that look, something like 30% of Italian wines coming into the U.S. are fakes, right? They're frauds. It's not what it is. That's not a Brunello. That's not a Sangiovese. Blah blah. That's super high end. It's probably wine, right? It's probably decent wine even. But it's maybe a $10 wine as opposed to the $50 or $70 bottle that you're presumably getting the real deal for. So again, I don't know if those numbers are still current, but you know, if really about a third of what's on that shelf, you don't know what it is, right? I mean, literally, we're talking about a bottle that anybody could put a label onto.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know? And blockchain, because it can track across the product distribution spectrum, right? From legal cannabis, you know, out here, seed to sale, right? That's become a methodology. And so whether it's agricultural products, whether it's industrial products, whether it's clothing items, again, I'm not the hip person I once was, right? But Air Jordans or whatever the hot sneaker might be. How do you really know? And blockchain is an answer to that, because the degree to which it is tracked and maintained and authenticated at every stage of the process is what's more revolutionary about it, right? And encryption underlies all of it, but it's really the fact that you've got a process across the distribution chain, and just like blockchain being used as a currency, every transaction that Bitcoin has been involved in from its origin is carried in a register. And that register file grows and develops over time. It is a living record, but it's constantly authenticated to make sure that it's honest and nobody's adapted it or changed it for their own purposes. So, you know, getting to honesty in relationships, you know, in terms of trust and validation, I mean, you know, any person in business ultimately knows that their business is based on trust, you know, with its customers, with its suppliers, with you know, partners, and, you know, maintaining that trust, how deep do you want to go? I just feel like blockchain extends it to a much deeper and more rigorous level than other approaches might. But Andrew, I do want to come back to your point about dinner table discussions in Silicon Valley.
I'm interested in that. Tell us, what do they talk about?
You know, I don't think it's so different than in Bedford and in Boston and in any place, right? So when you bring together people from different backgrounds here, just like any place, there's a certain depth that somebody brings that nobody else will have at that table. And therefore, just like any place else, it's perfectly all right to ask somebody, hey, what are you involved in? And then they give you the esoteric, wonky sort of answer that you're kind of like, oh, okay, I kind of get it. And then you ask the natural question, which is, as you just did, right? Well, how does this apply? What do people use it for? What is this good for? Hey, tell me about the customer you've affected, or tell me how the outcome has improved for someone. You know, we've got, I'm going to say, a cornucopia of interesting technologies. But any single one of them, if you were to come across a subject matter expert, they're way beyond the depth of anybody else, right? So even for me as a semiconductor / physical security / you know, compute technology kind of guy, I ran across a lot of biotechnology here, and it is way beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
So asking somebody to simplify and explain at a basic level, that's par for the course. And nobody gets offended. And in fact, the best technologists that I've ever come across, and I would argue both of you have the same experience, the best technologists do automatically bring the technology down to a simple, straightforward level.
Right.
And, you know, don't get into the jargon and don't get into the thing. Unless somebody asks, you know, unless permission is given.
Right. And, you know, that is, I think, a very good sign for very smart people who are looking to entice investors.
Mm-hmm.
It's always good to, you know, when you're making that pitch, to be able to explain what it is, you know, what mm-hmm. is it, so that, you know, your grandmother could understand it, you know.
Yeah, there are initiatives on the web that you'll see now that people will actually present they'll put the phrase in plain language.
Right.
They'll add that to whatever. So I was putting a presentation together today, and there was a topic I didn't know. And so I put in the topic I was looking for, and I just appended in plain language. And, you know, it got like, you know, 2 million hits on the search engine variations of that. And there's even an initiative in the government to simplify language and have things in plain language.
Right.
You know, you really have touched on a very important issue here, Andrea. I mean,
well, just, you know, disruptive technology is so exciting because we've just lived through, but even like going to the cloud, right? Was that disruptive? If we look back on disruptive technologies.
The shift to the cloud is probably.
The shift to the cloud.
Right. And now the important shift to the edge, because that's one of the things I'm involved in. So.
What's that?
Yeah.
The edge of the cloud where things are happening. The interface to the IoT, Internet of Things.
Oh, right.
We'll do another show on that.
No. Okay. So, and security. And now cybersecurity. And I feel as though we live in a world where, and we do wake up every day to the breaches around the world.
Oh yeah,
and that impacts everybody because we don't feel very secure. Like I don't even bank online. Which is stupid, right?
Well, yeah. So let me pick up on that, John, and challenge you a little bit. You know, I think it's clear to everybody that the digital world, the cyber world, is where a lot of things are happening. But what the heck could be new in the world of guards and guns? You know, physical security. What? I mean, is it a, you know, you move from a 45 to a 38 or, a, you know, or right. some non-lethal kind of weapon or a different kind of breed of dog to guard the air? I mean, what kind of technology can you really apply to, you know, physical security?
Oh, boy, you've put a good challenge there. But no, I'll actually steal the words of one of our business partners, right? So there's a security, physical security company based in Kansas City, Missouri, called Kenton Brothers for Security. And they're one of our business partners, channel partners. They sell our products. And they're an interesting example because if you talk to their CEO, Gina Stolke, she is the great-great-great-granddaughter, maybe I'm missing one in there, of the founder. Right, so it's carried through the family more than 150 years in business in Kansas City as Kenton Brothers. And her point, which she makes more eloquently than I will, is that the last 5 years have changed more than the last 150 years for their business.
Right.
Because of exactly what you're saying, Don. People think of physical security as the guards and the dogs and the, you know, key management and you know, blast-proof shelters. And, I mean, you can go on and on the physical aspects of the industry. But when you really are addressing physical threats today, such as terrorism, such as cyber threats, such as school shootings, right, there's a different dimension. I mean, let me just stop on that. And you know, we have now today shooter detection systems, right? So if somebody fires a shot, and I'm not sure about Bedford, but probably some of the municipalities around you probably have.
Yeah, Boston
these shooter
does.
Detection. Yeah, near Boston as you get to bigger cities.
What are you saying?
Oh, a shooter detection system. So if somebody fires a gun downtown, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you get as police today is not just, hey, we heard something, but there's actually a sophisticated system in many downtown areas or, you know, there are other parts of cities where through triangulation, right, different microphones hearing the shot from different places, the police not only get an alert that says there's been a shot fired, it's specific to exactly where. And you might even have follow-on information that comes from the listening of that. So that's been in place for a few years now, and you know many cities use them. What's, to me, more interesting and fantastic is that it's moving quickly because of school shootings and other factors to shooter detection, meaning you think that somebody is likely to pull out a gun and start firing. So now you're using technology to get better sophisticated information, better ability to thwart the attacker, better public safety overall from that, right? So you've got shooter detection is a specific thing, specific technology in physical security that just literally didn't exist 10 years ago or 15 probably, came into real full force probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and now is going through a resurgence to try to up the game to prevent the shooting from even happening. So that's an application of technology to a real physical security problem. And the sophistication of the technology has to be there, because if you're a police officer receiving that information, you need to trust it. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got a failure rate on that detection of 95%, well, guess what?
That's not
no
good.
Alert is going to be paid attention to.
No. Right.
Right. But if you have pretty good accuracy, right? If you're 60% of the time you detect that person's likely, has a, rifle stuck in their overcoat, whatever. If you're able to prevent that from happening, 60% is probably pretty good.
Wow.
And hopefully as an industry, we'll get to 100% over time. But that's really where I see the innovation in physical security coming. It's sure, you always have to have some physical presence and so forth, but it's the use of more advanced analytics, more advanced detection and sensor technologies. All of those things are really changing the nature of how people view physical security. Here's another example. If you go to a major sporting event, it is incredible to me how security is done. Right? This is from somebody in the industry. And really, step back from it. It's shocking how few issues are present in large stadium-type events. What's referred to as game day security, it's probably viewed within the industry as best in class, right? The technologies, the techniques, the approaches, the layers, multiple layers of security. I went to a baseball game about a week ago, Citi Field in New York, to see the Mets. And the layers of security are so invisible, but I had no doubt, knowing what I know, so to speak, that within probably a minute or two of entering that stadium, I had already been photographed probably multiple times. That imagery had already been sent for analysis. I've already been checked against databases of likely terrorists or what have you. And, my motions and activities are being tracked so that, predictive analytics can be applied to it.
So everyone, you're saying everyone.
Everyone, every single person,
not just
of course.
You, but everyone, right? No. I mean, because really, for those
everyone,
of us who aren't in that realm, it's completely invisible to us. We think it's still
the
world.
Well, that's the key.
We think it's metal detectors. Oh, went through security. That's it. And that is so, frankly, mind-blowing. By the way, before I forget, I just want to tell everyone, they're listening to WBNH 105.1, Bedford Community Radio. And our guest today is John Gallagher. He's the VP of marketing for a company, Viaku. And he's actually speaking to us from California. So thank you for joining us. And he's an expert in all things disruptive.
He's a disruptive personality.
Yeah, right.
Andrew, but let me pick up on what we were just talking about, which is you're amazed by it, and you're partly amazed because it's invisible. Well, that improves security, right? Because if it is truly invisible, then the evildoers, right, the bad folk out there, they're not aware necessarily of the layers and multiple layers that are there. So they might catch one or two, but they're not going to catch the 10 that are active.
Yeah.
And again, here's an example I just came across a month ago or so, and I'm still toying with it. And it's not just what we in the physical security industry are doing; it's the combination of technologies broadly that are feeding into this. You've all heard of YouTube, and you may have heard of a thing called DeepMind, maybe not. Okay, so DeepMind is basically an advanced AI computer system, let's just call it that Alphabet, the parent company of Google, does. Well, So here's an interesting factoid. They put DeepMind, picture it this way, in front of a TV screen and shoved billions of hours of YouTube videos in front of, into DeepMind. And so guess what? The best lip readers in the world get somewhere around 50-60% accuracy at best. DeepMind can do 95% accuracy without ever having watched a real human talk. And how we in the physical security industry can take advantage of that in the future, and probably not too far in the future, is that if you've got, as every shopping mall, every shopping center typically does, you've got a parking lot video surveillance system. It's looking at activities. And right now, they all use analytics that will look at, this car parked, nobody got out of it, another car came in 2-5 minutes later, the guy from that car got into the other car, something was exchanged, the guy went, came out of the car with a bag of something or whatever. Hey, that was a drug deal, right?
Yeah.
Maybe. Right. Maybe they were just, whatever, sharing clothes or something. And where it's headed, though, is that that's going to be very quickly combined with reading those lips. Hmm. Because now you have an engine that's automated, that's analytical, with a 95% accuracy that can remotely tell what people are saying. Hmm. You have to believe that that will be used for physical security, and it will actually improve physical security.
That
will be also used for malicious reasons. Will it be used by the bad people? Will it be used potentially for civil rights violations? Absolutely. Right. There's no technology that I've ever come across, anything, that is value neutral.
Yeah.
But, you're not going to stop the technology. So how you adapt to it and how you use it, hopefully for good, as we plan to in physical security with something like lip reading. That could really save lives and improve, people's overall sense of safety.
And it's interesting how that was one of the key parts of 2001, A Space Odyssey, right? Where Hal was lip reading as they were talking and realizing they were getting ready to shut him down. And
there you go.
And they set him up.
Exactly.
So, right. So
good one.
They previewed that, several decades ago that we would be moving to that. All right, so you've got me a little bit convinced maybe the sort of old-style business of security is one that can be updated. Actually, when I mentioned to Andrea before the show began, as we were doing our several hours of show prep, that we would be talking about disruptive technology here, she said, well, what about stone cutting? And absolutely. I mean, some of the engraving and so technology is really coming in to all of these areas. But are they displacing humans? Are we really going to have a problem of leisure in the future where humans are seeking something to do because robotics and AI and other technologies are going to take and displace all the value added jobs that we're all doing?
Well, I'm hoping. No.
So you can sit back and mine Bitcoins.
I like a life of leisure with my...
Hey, it's one of the causes of the failure of the Roman Empire, right? Too many slaves,
right.
Put them under. So,
or all of us who were raised on the Jetsons. I mean,
right, sure.
Where's Rosie the Robot, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've come across as many views on that, even here in Silicon Valley, as I think you'd find anywhere. There are a lot of different views on how that will play out. And there's some, I'm going to say very hopeful and very optimistic views that lead to more satisfying, lives for people. There's also, maybe the more extreme version. I mean, there's a big movement. I shouldn't say big, but there's a movement here. Actually, Ray Kurzweil, right, MIT. He wrote a book probably 10, 12 years ago now, called The Singularity is Near. And if you haven't looked into it, there's the Singularity Institute now, the Singularity University here.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of that movement, the Singularity folks, is that they believe that, hey, not only are we going to become more cyber-infused, let's say, or cyber-enhanced, But ultimately, where it is leading to is that we create another human species, right? I mean, think of it this way. They call it the augmentation. So if you are given the opportunity to get 1,000 times as much brain power, 1,000 times as much memory capacity, and the ability to learn a language instantly, all you have to do is have this chip implanted, you know, back of your head. Well, the concept is that the chip per se is not really a chip. It's genetic material. It's organic material. And once augmented, once you breed with somebody else who's augmented, your children automatically have that augmentation. Hmm. Voila. Humans are now reduced to dogs, and the superior life form has taken over. So that, to me, is probably the scariest of the outcomes. I mean, but there's a lot of scary outcomes that potentially can happen. And somewhere in the middle is the idea that we're left with a life of leisure and that we're unfulfilled because of it, and we're going to need social support and universal basic income and so forth. But I honestly would say there's as many views as there are that spectrum of, hey, it's our savior and the panacea for a great future, or it's the end of humanity. And personally, I honestly don't know where we really are on that spectrum. I have to believe that as we do get closer to something like the singularity, or as we get closer to the transition point where really bad things might happen, that we will have, of course, the human intelligence and decency and so forth to not go there. But you know, again, no technology is value neutral, right? Every technology has positive and negative impacts on society and people. So, yeah, I mean, we are headed towards more automation, more capabilities, more artificial intelligence to make decision-making much faster than we can as people. I mean, I'm shamelessly a fan of self-driving cars, even though they're not here yet. But I know inherently that they will be much, much, much safer. Yeah. And if I'm going to step into a vehicle, I personally would want to step into a self-driving one as opposed to one that I'm responsible for or some other human with its human limitations is responsible for.
Right. And big news in that area today with a $2+ billion commitment on the part of SoftBank to Chrysler's self-driving car initiative.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah? As part of an overall $100 billion investment that SoftBank's putting into Silicon Valley.
Right.
They bought Arm. They've made a lot of investments, and this is just yet another part of it. That's something to watch.
You know, just to back up for a minute, you know, you were talking about not the field of medicine, but this idea that you can augment a human to be more than a human. You know, just to back that up a little bit, we live in such a stratified world with, you know, there are people with many, 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 many more resources than others that have access to so much more medical technology than the run-of-the-mill human being does. And I'm wondering how much it's disruptive technology in medicine that most of us don't get to access, but I'm wondering if it's to that point where those at the very top can access custom technology.
Wow.
Well, that's the premise of this of the movie with Tom Cruise, where the elite are living in a cloud city, and the struggle of the majority of the billions of people on Earth is trying to they're starving and they don't have access to the great medical stuff, and so the very elite few are living up there, and of course the as you can imagine, the story is that someone's trying to get up there to cure their daughter who has cancer.
Oh,
and
well,
so you're spot
so
on with it.
Well, it's a little science. It's still
it's speculative fiction,
but
it comes from reality. And the other thing, and I think John was just about to allude to this at one point. The other part of the singularity is that you can achieve immortality because what you do is you transfer your consciousness to silicon, and you live forever. Inside a simulated world.
Talk about disruptive technology.
Well, that's different from the singularity, but it's another.
Well, it's one of the consequences of the singularity, right, is that you would have the ability to do that.
I got to tell you, I'm just so happy I know how to work my microwave. You know, and also I often think, you know, because I'm not quite as old as Don, And even though my background
I'm
is
29.
In science background, I'm just glad that I have been in the workforce all these years, because my friends that have not been in the workforce all these years are at a loss. You know, if you don't use technology, if you don't use it, you lose it. I mean, and so for someone like yourself, John, who is obviously immersed in it, you know, it's second nature to you. And
but so are you, because I mean, you see all these new businesses coming in. People are it's not necessarily technology based, but everyone who comes to you with a new idea are trying to be disruptive in a field because someone is already delivering the service or the product that they're looking to do. They're just trying to do it in a different way.
Well, even just
right?
Being able to talk to John about disruptive technology and hear the kind of descriptive words you're using, it just is really just so lovely. I have not to. Listen, do you need anybody that has a degree in physics?
She's pitching her son who just graduated. So.
Sorry.
Well, you know, John, this also one of the other things you touched on there that just to relate it to the audience who've been listening to our show, we've had a couple of shows that have emphasized the need of adults to constantly learn. And I think that's another thing that you're saying here, Andrea, right. is that learning is a lifelong task. So we've had people in from different universities here talking about the changing nature of the student population that they're dealing with. And I think you even see that out in Silicon Valley these days, right?
Mm. Well, that's a sensitive one.
Yeah, it still is a young person's business, right?
Well, you know, it always has been, you know, and that's just one of the realities. I mean, it's what drew me as a young person out here and is not such a young person anymore. I'm still finding it's a great, you know, business environment. But it is a challenge. I mean, like, you know, in hiring, right, that's where the rubber really hits the road. I mean, you've probably heard the phrase culture fit.
Right.
It's used a lot in hiring discussions in Silicon Valley. Is this person a fit with our culture? Because I think, you know, the younger generation has brought that more to the forefront in the workplace. And you know, maybe rightfully so, right? I mean, you want productive work teams, you want camaraderie, you want a team spirit, you want all those things. And people who don't fit with the culture, right, you know, go against that.
Yeah, you remind me of a story I was told of some people that went on one of the Google campuses looking to go on a sales call, and they were a little lost, and they stopped somebody and said, can you tell me how to get to so-and-so? And they said, oh, is that where your children are working in that building? So yeah, so you're right. There is still the rule of the young. I did want to come back though. I'm sorry. Go ahead. If you wanted to finish the topic, because I did want to ask you one other thing after that.
I did want to inject one thing, which is a great book I read over the holidays. I'm sorry I didn't read it when it first came out. And it's a Bostonian who wrote it, Dan Lyons, who was a Newsweek editor for a long time, a technology editor. And he went to work as a mid-50s-ish person for HubSpot, which is arguably a disruptive high-tech startup in the Boston area. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting read just from the perspective of how he wasn't a culture fit. And that maybe raises the issue that is kind of still in the air here, which is that culture fit does cut both ways because it can be used to do age discrimination or other discriminatory actions. And so it's a phrase that's used, I'm going to say, with two sides, you know. Anyway.
No, I mean, you know,
finish the point there.
Yeah. But you know, this whole topic of disruptive technology, constantly changing technology has – I think disenfranchised a certain portion of the workforce that, I mean, sure, there's menial labor, but to really be able to be in the thick of all this technology, you have to, I mean, maybe I'm generalizing and, you know, inappropriately, but I think you have to be in the thick of it to stay in it.
Well, you know, let me challenge you, Andrea, just because, right? If you go back in time, to when personal computers started coming around, A few years after the launch of the XT, I think, whatever, the PC XT or AT, whatever, early Microsoft Windows DOS type machines, and when Apple came out. So a few years into it, they did a study, right? Who really is using this stuff, this new stuff? And the assumption was, oh, it's all the young folk. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't. It was a bimodal distribution that was centered somewhere in mid to late 20s. And then the other mode was centered somewhere in mid to late 50s, right? And why was it? It's because as people started to turn towards retirement or start to, they're maybe ready and willing and able because their work requirements are less or their family responsibilities are less, or whatever. They actually are back to having time and space to absorb new things.
Yeah,
I mean, we all live such crazy busy lives, you know, that having that bandwidth. Again, I mean, as you're in the thick of career and family and so forth, it becomes awfully hard to throw a few cherries on top. But when you get to a point where you're able to, I mean, that's why, as I look around, you know, sorry, it's just last night, saw a commercial for the Jitterbug smartphone.
Oh, yes. Right? I know what you're talking about.
And I thought to myself, you know, my in-laws, you know, older people who I know, right, 70s, 80s, they all use iPhones, right?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think to myself, who's the market for this Jitterbug smartphone? Because most of the older folk I know, they adopted smartphones back years ago, and they're quite comfortable continuing on. And in fact, they're looking to buy the next generation. I mean, maybe not for the same reasons as younger folk might, but there's definitely a comfort that people can find in adopting new technology later in life.
Well, with a large population, there is still the product adoption curve. There are the laggers that are way out there. So, by the way, everybody, we're listening to WBNH 105.1 FM here, and our guest today, we're having a really wonderful conversation with John Gallagher of Viacu. John is the Vice President of Marketing. And an expert on really many different fields of technology, and he's helping us understand something about disruption and innovation, and even how disruption and innovation have a role to play in well-established industries, not just in the new industries. And we've been going through a number of examples here, John. So, so thank you for that. I did want to return, if I may, to something you said just about 10, 15 minutes ago when we were talking about security at the stadiums. And the fact that these technologies they will be used for both good and bad. And some of the issues, you know, potentially have to do with, you know, false positives and how people will be affected by that as we allow more and more, and I'll use an energized word here, intrusion into our or you know, breaking into our privacy through the use of these technologies. There is the potential of people having bad effects from false positives that are generated out there. We even see that today in terms of people being accused of things and having to deal with reputation management systems as a new class of companies that are emerging on the internet trying to help people preserve them. So do you have some thoughts about false positives? And in your business and in the security area, is this an issue that people are aware of? Is it something getting attention?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It always has. In fact, it's a big issue. I mean, you know, if you've got listeners who work in small businesses, you know, as I do, right, in a startup, you know, you just run into cases where you realize there's a significant consequence to these false positives. I mean, we're in a you know, office type area, and you know, but it's a small office, and you know, every now and then somebody will probably knock against our door, or something will happen, the alarm gets triggered, nobody's there, it's on a weekend or at night, and you know, police come, and after a couple visits they'll start charging you. So their basic point is, hey, these false positives cost us and it takes away from other public safety. So, you know, they're trying to put the burden via taxation, one might argue, onto us to reduce those false positives. And in the same way, within the physical security technology space, there's actually a lot of technologies. There's what's called video verification, which is that before police might respond to an audio alarm type alerting mechanism, do some video capture and have the police look at that as well, right? So even if they have to come, they're coming better informed and so forth. They know something about what the situation is. And that's really what it comes down to, is it's a situational interpretation, and you are going to have false positives. And as I mentioned earlier, right, if you have a 95% failure rate, that's the same as it not working, and nobody will trust it. The 5%, they'll let go. But once you get to a level where you've balanced the, you know, value, right, you've saved lives, you've reduced threats, you've improved safety, against the, hey, we just had to waste another, you know, call, we had to do another drive, we had to, you know, whatever, there will be that balance point. But the technologies like video verification, sure, it's a false alarm, and now people will be able to tell that it's a false alarm much more quickly and, you know, reduce the cost or the burden of that. But again, it's a balancing act. And the verification angle, again, I'm still going to come back to things like machine learning, AI. Once you're able to feed systems large amounts of data that have some understanding associated with them, you're going to then have very well-trained systems. I mean, in our environment, we've got probably about 200 million hours worth of metadata around how video surveillance and access control systems behave. And that's why we hire and use machine learning and AI type technologists and data scientists, because by looking at and analyzing these situations, we can take what maybe is a not very accurate system or environment for detecting problems, and over time make it very accurate. And the more data you can throw, the better the accuracy becomes. So I think, you know, when it comes to data science and, you know, the strides we've made in the last 5 to 10 years, that issue will always exist, but it's getting less. Because the worst thing is, I mean, I'm sorry to cherry pick this one, but this just really stuck with me from about 4 or 5 years ago. About 5 years ago, the city of Philadelphia spent, you know, 20, 25 million of city funds to put in a surveillance system downtown. And after a year, they audited it, and they found that it worked 35% of the time. Wow. Then they re-audited it a year later. They gave them some funds to try to fix it. It was like it's 33%. Well, guess what? They've pretty much pulled the plug on it. There's a quote about 4 years ago from the chief of police. They're saying, we don't use that. We can't rely on it. If there's an incident and we need video verification or video evidence, we go to private businesses. Mm-hmm. They know how to run their stuff right, better than we do. I mean, so, you know, is the city of Philadelphia safer for that? I would argue no. It would have been better for that investment to have, you know, paid out by, you know, working and providing safety and so mm-hmm. forth. But, you know, you're always going to have that balancing act of, you know, do you try to deploy an advanced technology early and you deal with those false positives or deal with its lack of success? Mm-hmm. Or do you, you know, stick with it and, again, hope the technology develops over time to improve, as, again, almost every technology does?
Mm, interesting. So, I have to share with you that recently the state of New Hampshire initiated a stakeholder group to look at school violence, school place violence, and how to prevent it. And one of the work groups looks specifically at technology. Mm. And they invited a series of vendors to come in and talk about their technology to, you know, with the goal of making some recommendations as to next steps and how we can make our schools safer. So, you know, that whole security school is so important now, especially, you know, when you look at the news and you...
Well, it grabs the headlines for sure.
Yeah, around schools. And you think it would be, it's not just how do you lock the door?
Right.
It's too, you know... That's not really the technology we should be focused on. I think it's how do you, you know, is the cadence of that person approaching the school, you know, how's,
Bingo.
And then, but boy, you have to react fast. That data has to be analyzed quickly. And
that's why you have to do it on the edge of the cloud, not in the cloud.
Right, right.
But that's a topic for another time.
Exactly. That's where you get into the concept of fast data. You know, the response time is so limited that you really have to maybe rethink how you're processing that data, and timing is everything. But you know, to follow along with that, Andrew, what is good is that, again, states like New Hampshire are really trying to dialogue around this and get voices and ideas and concepts introduced to improve things, right? Mm-hmm. That's always going to be helping to improve things, right? I mean, it doesn't need to be disruptive technology, but there is a role for technology to play in it. And by the way, if technology is too disruptive, it's a deterrent to having it used. I mean, that's what I found. I mean, when, you know, we're a 5-year-old company, but when we were a 2-year-old company, I tried to give to schools. Actually, there was a school safety, you know, big focus on school safety. We were attending school safety conferences, campus safety. Actually, some of our largest, one of our largest groupings of customers is higher education. And we tried to get into K through 12 by offering once a month, we would pick a school, you know, hey, you know, nominate your school to be, you know, the Viacu school, you know, safety school of the month, whatever. We had no takers. Hmm. We had people who applied, and then we tried to give them the free use of our product for a year. Yeah. And we didn't have any takers because it always came down to, oh, okay, well, at the school level, we really need this. Like, I had one talk with the principal who said, look, every time video fails, I have to take a guard from someplace else and have them manually man that place that's not being observed. Mm-hmm. And that's reducing our safety at the school. Mm. Wow, I could really use what you guys are doing. And we check back in every week or say, hey, well, what's going on? And it's like, oh, well, we really can't adopt what you're doing because the district has a policy around they control software. They don't want us to be installing something unless they vetted it. Mm-hmm. They said, oh, they'd get around to it in a year or two. Yeah. I mean, you know, bureaucracy came in to play.
Well, you got
to
start.
And is it because we're disruptive? Probably. I mean, if we were on every school superintendent's desk, we might not be, we might have had a lot of takers.
Well, it's hard to believe, John, but we're actually at the end of our time with you. But I would say that this is only installment one. We'd love to have you come back and, let us pick up on some of the other topics that we just didn't get time to. You've been a really terrific guest for us today.
I'd love to.
Wondering if you have any last-minute things you'd like to say. And also, we'd like to ask you to let our audience know if they wanted to learn more about Viacu, or I know you put out a blog, or if they wanted to find you on the net. What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, well, Viacu is not the easiest word to pronounce or spell, so let me just do that. It's V-I-A-K-O-O. The meaning of the company name is, it's a Latin root for through listening. And so basically, check out our website, you know, www.viacu.com. Our blog is at blog.viacu.com. The other resource that I'd really point people to is the security industry does have, again, a lot of interesting organizations and industry associations that really are taking a lead on adoption of technologies. And probably the biggest of those is SIA, the Security Industry Association. So I'd point some of your listeners to that to get a sense of what's going on technology-wise in the industry.
Well, that's great. Thank you so very much for being our guest. And as we do each week here, I think we're going to turn it over to my friend and colleague, Andrea O'Brien, who spends her time advising hundreds of companies in New England and especially New Hampshire about what to do in business. And I wonder, Andrea, do you have any sage advice for us as we sign off for today?
Well, I'd like to thank John also for making the time to speak with us. And I'd like to remind our listening audience, you can spend more than you make, but you can only do it for so long.